I'm Tariq Osman, and here on the BBC World Service, it's the final part of my historical journey, the making of the modern Arab world, where I'll be looking at the decade leading up to the Arab Spring. We're now in the early 2000s, and you could say things have ground to a halt.
We are now in Duqi, in central Cairo. We've been waiting now for about 25 minutes almost without any kind of move. Tens and tens of cars in the tunnel here that leads us to the other bank of the Nile.
Just being stuck on the street in Cairo in your car, it's a miserable condition, to be honest. When it takes you like 3 or 4 hours to get from one place to another, it's really hard to go to your work, it's really hard to meet with friends. Just the mere state of our traffic reflects how miserable we are. We're just stuck anywhere we are. Basically, in our economic situation, in our traffic situation is suffocating us, and political situation, we're reaching some sort of a dead end. So yeah, it's all connected somehow. In my opinion, it's one of the main reasons for why people revolted in 2011.
As young Egyptian activist Sara al-Masri states quite clearly, by the first decade of the 21st century, the entire Arab world seemed to be stuck in a jam. A sense of malaise and stagnation had spread across the region, and a shared feeling emerged, which was summed up in a phrase regularly heard in conversation, "Fi haga ghalat," something has gone wrong. The dream of Arab nationalism had descended into authoritarian regimes dominated by strong men, such as Mubarak in Egypt, Ben Ali in Tunisia, and Gaddafi in Libya. At the same time, a young generation, tens of millions like Sarah, was entering the scene, inheriting a very long list of social, political, and economic challenges. In this program, we see what happens when these stalled, aging rulers have to contend with the frustrations and aspirations of this young generation eager to get moving. Egyptian activist Jawad Nabulsi and Professor Eugene Rogan of the University of Oxford.
Most of the states across the Arab world in the course of the 1970s, 80s, 90s had settled into dynastic rule. This was as true in the Arab republics, where Saddam Hussein ruled Iraq and raised his sons to succeed him, or where Hafez al-Assad in Syria was grooming his sons to succeed him. Indeed, in Libya, you have Muammar Gaddafi fomenting some struggle among his own sons over which one would succeed him, but no doubt of the succession, or in Egypt, where Hosni Mubarak was grooming his son Gamal.
It was insulting to our intelligence that out of 90 million Egyptians, or at that time was probably like 80 million Egyptians, there isn't one Egyptian who is qualified, aside from the son of the president, to run this country.
These rulers, believing themselves beyond the reach of citizen action, began to cultivate a narrower and narrower group of supporters by ensuring that a coterie around the presidency benefited from whatever economic opportunities there were. This meant that a small group of people got immensely rich, while the vast majority of the population in each of these countries grew increasingly poorer. And as the inequality in society grew, the lie of the promises of these aging autocrats, each one of whom had come to power on the promise of social justice and the provision for the needs of the citizen, was becoming more and more apparent.
And you couldn't see a light. You couldn't see a way of change. So we're not going to be just waiting for 10 years. We'll be waiting for the next 40 years.
And to make matters worse, each of these autocrats was presenting the citizens with the son who would be their successor. It was a system that risked perpetuating itself, and it was something that drove Arab citizens across the region into despair.
So I was one of the people who actually decided to leave Egypt after my high school and just go as far as possible and chose Canada. It just felt that this way of life is going to continue forever.
Egypt is the largest Arab country and the focus of this program. But the frustrations that Jawad and his generation felt were not unique to Egypt. and existed across the Arab world.
The president of Syria, Hafez al-Assad, has died in Damascus. He held power for 30 years as the head of a tough and authoritarian regime.
And it was in Syria that for the first time ever in an Arab republic, a son inherited the presidency from his father, BBC Syria correspondent Lina Sinjab. How did the people react to Bashar al-Assad's succession?
At the time of the death of Hafez al-Assad, people had no idea what's going to happen to them. There was a passive reception to what the security regime is going to introduce to them. But at the same time, and I'm talking here about the masses, at the same time they felt, this is a young man who's coming, he's educated in Britain, he's an eye doctor, maybe he's going to bring something new for the country. And there was hope for majority of Syrians. Now, if you're talking about the intellectual elite or the opposition elite, of course they didn't welcome that. This is inheritance. This is a power being delivered from the father to the son in a government that is under a republican constitution, not a monarchy. That's why immediately after Bashar al-Assad took power, a movement of civil society introducing a bit of democracy started, which is the Damascus Spring. But soon after that, it was oppressed and many of its members were locked in prison.
In North Africa as well, there were hopes for change. But soon, these hopes were dashed. The activist Yusra Ghannouchi recalls what happened in Tunisia under Ben Ali, another strong man.
Really, after a first few years of promises of democratization, all Tunisians saw was ruling with an iron hand, repression, a police state. In a small country like Tunisia, there are over 200,000 policemen in a population of 10 million, and people were too afraid to criticize the government or anyone related to the government or to voice their opinion on anything, really. And with the rise of corruption of Ben Ali and the families around him who controlled most of the economy, the middle class became squeezed. The Tunisians started feeling more impoverished. Whereas Tunisians continued to be highly educated, there were no jobs to cater for them. So young people saw their hopes blocked.
I'm 38 years old. In my lifetime, the Arab world has almost doubled its population. Out of over 320 million Arabs today, two-thirds are under 25. This young generation witnessed economic growth, a boom in many sectors from real estate to telecoms, and huge wealth being accumulated by a tiny elite. But for the vast majority of these young Arabs, this growth, these opportunities, were beyond reach. Sara al-Rashidi is an Anglo-Egyptian journalist.
I'd like to talk about a dear friend of mine, my taxi driver, Mohammed Ramadan. I think he's a very good example of an educated young Egyptian man. He illustrates the mass problem here, lack of opportunity for the youth in terms of employment. My taxi driver, Mohammed, hasn't graduated yet, but he's studying law. He's driving a taxi. He probably said he will not complete his law degree. He'd rather try and move to Kuwait, that is his intention, to drive a taxi over there where he thinks he'll have a better life and earn more money because there are no opportunities here for him. This is the story of the majority of the youth, I'm very saddened to say.
Many decided to opt out. Some of the best and the brightest would leave for jobs in Europe or the region's shiny new commercial hubs, such as Dubai and Qatar. Many of those who stayed isolated themselves inside gated communities. And thousands of poor Arabs were willing to risk their lives to cross the Mediterranean to the southern shores of Europe in search of a better life. Growing populations were neglected by their own leaders, and the Arab world didn't figure highly on the international agenda. But by 2003, the region was about to be thrust into the global spotlight.
We hope that the Iraqi regime will meet the demands of the United Nations and disarm fully and peacefully. If it does not, we are prepared to disarm Iraq by force. Either way.
By the first decade of the 21st century, the Arab world had probably hit the low point in its modern history. Since the events of 9/11, the region as a whole had been acted on by the United States and its allies in a way that had shown all of the Arab political elites were impotent. There was nothing anyone could do against the will of the United States under its neoconservative president. And there was absolutely no sense of respect for the people or the governments of the Arab world. And at the same time, the people themselves began to look at their rulers with a critical eye. They saw their presidents as ineffectual, corrupt, and they knew that if they took the pain to express their dissent with that political order, that the repressive state would very quickly round them up and put them in jail. And so this sense of being unable to stand up against foreign powers or even have control over your destiny at home left anyone with half of an education feeling like half of a man, half of a woman.
But the spirit of change has already been awoken. There was a growing culture of protest in different Arab countries, such as Lebanon, Bahrain, and Egypt, and especially in universities and professional associations of lawyers, doctors, and journalists. From 2005 on, crowds belonging to the Kifaya, or Enough movement, which opposed the handing down of power from Mubarak to his son, would gather on street corners in Cairo and Alexandria, typically facing anti-riot police. Here, they're chanting, "You people have waited for too long. Raise your voice with freedom." Elements within these regimes were aware of the acute need for change from within. Whether Bashar Assad when he came to power in Syria in 2000, or the anointed heirs in several Arab republics, such as Gamal Mubarak in Egypt and Saif al-Islam Qaddafi in Libya, all introduced some economic reforms and tried to modernize decision-making in several areas. But like the societies they ruled, the regimes were also at a standstill. Their fathers, Mubarak, Qaddafi and others, were growing old, bunkered down within isolated circles of acolytes and interest groups, detached from their societies. The leading Egyptian socioeconomist Heba Handoussa.
In Egypt, we were working on the National Human Development Report, and the theme was decentralization. So you can think a big chunk of it being political liberalization and democratization. Unfortunately, it's the same year when we had elections by 2005 for parliament, and something like 88 Muslim Brotherhood people entered the parliament. So this terrified the state regime, and after we had been communicating with the National
Democratic
Party, the NDP, and they were totally keen to implement a big decentralization policy and working on a draft law, etc., it was all stopped, but it remains the most beautiful of reports on how things should be.
So the attempts at changing these regimes from within did not materialize. The young were still stuck. But did Arab liberalism, Islamism, and nationalism, the ideologies that had inspired previous generations of Arabs, have anything to offer the new generation? Sara Al-Masri.
I think my generation, 18 years old and above, I would say that we're really sick and tired of all of those ideologies. What we youth are trying to do right now is to, and I belong to that group who are asking for, it's not an ideology still, but it's a solution that we believe in that will solve our current crisis.
They're not looking to repeat Nasserism. They're not looking to repeat one of these old discredited ideologies with their political parties and their forms of representation and their bickering.
Dr. John Chalcraft of the London School of Economics.
There are many who are trying to think of politics in a new way. And I think that is somewhat generational. I have a dream the regime will fall,
and that what comes next is only better for us all. Now is the time of doing. The old generation said that we can't do it. And that's what I think one of the important points that we're facing right now is a generation war. Corruption, bribery, nepotism, tribal disputes. It's not much of an ideological war, it's a generation war.
The new generation had a new weapon in its arsenal, technology.
الاستيفان والمطالبة بإطلاق سراح
الخمسين. itself has mentioned a political roadmap.
الأمم المتحدة والاتحاد الأوروبي للسلطات الفلسطينية.
From satellite TV to mobile phones and the internet, information was now crossing borders instantaneously. People could watch what was happening elsewhere and listen to different viewpoints, and this was revolutionary in itself. The regimes were losing grip on an area they had controlled for decades, if not centuries, dictating the social agenda. The traffic, you might say, was starting to move.
Technology, Facebook, was very important. The ability to mobilize and to get the people together who had the same thoughts, who have the same opposition, that was new. So when I do an event, at that time we had like 70 or 80,000 people on that page.
As well as the newfound ability to mobilize through social networks, politicized art was also on the rise. Egyptian singer Samia Jaheen.
Young people were expressing how frustrated they were, sometimes demonstrating and sometimes making music and writing poetry and making films. They were trying in every possible way to say, we are unhappy, we are frustrated, we deserve better.
Thanks to satellite channels and social media, the Iranian uprising in 2009, spearheaded by the country's youth, did not go unnoticed in the Arab world. It entered people's living rooms. Political repression, severe social inequality, and corruption were becoming endemic. Arab republics were turning into dynastic fiefdoms, and the tension was mounting.
People were so frustrated and so devastated and so oppressed to the extent that they felt, we don't care if we just die.
It's very bad for my government. I haven't food, I haven't anything. Me and my children, I will die today.
They were angry at the police and they were angry at the economy and they were angry at their lives. I think anger was very important.
In Arabic, as in English, there's a proverb that says, Al-qashatu lati qasama dhahr al-ba'ir, the straw that broke the camel's back. That straw materialized in December 2010 in a remote Tunisian town when a young fruit seller called Mohammed Bouazizi clashed with a junior police officer. What happened next was caught on camera phone and spread virally across the internet. What once would have been instantly covered up by the authorities was suddenly out of their hands and sending shock waves around the whole region. This incident triggered a chain of events that was to fundamentally change the Arab world. Mohammed's sister, Samia.
So on the 17th of December, Mohammed went to sell his fruit and vegetables as usual. And as usual, the agents from the council asked for bribes, and again he refused. So they took his vegetables and fruit, took his goods, put them in their car. But then one of them asked for the scale he was using, and Mohammed refused. So at that point, a woman agent just smacked him on the face, and the other agents, there were three of them, started beating him, and Mohammed was crying and screaming and pleading with them, but they wouldn't stop. Mohammed after that went to the town hall to ask for his goods and his scale to be returned, but they refused. So then he went to the main government building and he asked again to have his goods returned to him, and he asked to see the governor, but the police prevented him. Again, he pleaded and cried and screamed, and it was obvious he was suffering so much, but still, they refused. So then he just went away, bought a bottle of petrol, and did this act.
This was a hugely symbolically significant event.
Dr. Lali Khalili from the School of Oriental and African Studies.
The self-immolation of Bouazizi essentially was a spark for the huge uprising that was already brewing under the surface. It's important to recognize that Bouazizi came from an area of Tunisia which was severely economically depressed, the phosphate belt, and he represented, in a sense, the thwarted hopes of the youth in many of the Arab states. Poverty, they rose, knee deep in robbery, souls plummet and burn
like Mohammed Bouazizi. No member of our family could believe that Mohammed was dead. But it's also a surprise to see all these people with Mohammed's big, big picture just taking the streets. It's a huge movement. Before, in Tunisia, there wasn't any justice or solidarity, fraternity. But now, owing to Mohammed, all young people can talk freely.
I do remember that moment because the fact that only 2 weeks after his death, Zain al-Abidin Ben Ali was forced to leave the country came as a shock. And then once the possibility became real that you could actually topple somebody who had been in power for more than two decades, as it had happened in Tunisia, people did break through the fear barrier.
People felt that if Tunisia could do it, we can do it too.
Thousands of protesters are defying the night curfew in Cairo as riot police struggle to control anti-government protests.
There's no going back. I'm just hoping that he is smart enough, wise enough, to let go before things get worse.
But did you think at that moment that you are creating history?
Yeah, the numbers we saw on the street spoke very loudly that something is completely different. But we didn't know there was going to be a revolution. But we know something huge, dramatic is going to happen, and Egypt's not going to be the same again.
All barriers fell down during those 18 days in that spot, Tahrir Square.
Ghada Shahbandar.
I have never felt more comfortable in any social or geographic space. No differences based on race, social class, gender. All barriers came down, and that was the beauty of it.
And we sang a song that was written by Amin Haddad on the 27th of January. It was called Raga'in. Raga'in means we're coming back to life, we're not dead, we are all united.
It's funny how every single moment in history where everybody thought this is the end, this is how we're going to be forever, and it will take years before people start realizing what they want and how they're going to achieve it. At those moments, Egyptians just do something that surprised the whole world. Maybe one of those times we will do it and manage to conserve it and to take care of it and to lead it further into real freedom.
So if we look at the last century and a half since the birth of the modern Arab world, the Arabs had tried various routes towards freedom and progress. The Arab liberal age in the first half of the 20th century introduced democracy, but despite the era's glamour, it failed to address the socio-economic ills of the Arab societies. Arab nationalism, especially during its heyday under Nasser in the 1950s and 60s, ushered in a dream of Arab unity and social equality. But that project proved to be just that, a dream. For many Arabs, Islamism was the solution. For others, it was relapse and deterioration. And for the past three decades, under many strongmen, Arab societies had neither a project nor a dream. But with this unprecedented wave of uprisings across the region, a new generation has managed to address the most fundamental idea, what it means to be an Arab. Yusra Ghannouchi, is being Arab today different than it was 30 years ago, 60 years ago, a century ago?
I think it's different from how it was 2.5 years ago. Being Arab had been associated in the media, and this influences Arabs themselves, associated with negative representations, associated with violence, misogyny, illiteracy, ignorance, poverty, being alien. And that affected Arabs themselves. Now, after the revolutions, it's being Arab is associated with activism, inspiration, pride, vibrancy. And despite the disappointments and the setbacks, this belief that Arabs have regained their own destiny and that they can make a difference and they can build their own societies.
The events of the past 3 years, since the beginning of what came to be known as the Arab Spring, took different directions. Some countries are progressing, albeit slowly, towards democracy. Others have descended into chaos and civil war. As Yusra says, this young generation is defining what it means to be an Arab. But there are major differences about what that means and on what different groups want for their societies. Some Arab countries will break free of the jam they were stuck in. Others will remain trapped. The Arab uprisings have unleashed the promise of a young generation, but also the peril of a complicated century. But regardless of the destinations that different Arab societies will arrive at, this young generation is already remaking the Arab world.